Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Are your food choices healthy for the planet? Many of us feel we're doing the right thing as we add organically grown and locally produced to the list of criteria we use to plan our diets. But do they guarantee we are creating a truly sustainable and globally scalable system of agriculture? Writer Paul Roberts explores these questions in his article for the current issue of Mother Jones magazine. It's called Spoiled. He is in North Texas to speak to the Owens Conference on Agricultural Sustainability and Food Safety at Austin College in Sherman. Paul, welcome to Think.
Oh, it's good to be here, Chris. Thanks.
You write that we need a whole new set of assumptions about what sustainability really means. What are our assumptions right now?
Well, they're really implicit. They're we have this idea, sort of vague idea, I think most of us, that there's something wrong with the current system of food production, and we know that we need some alternative, and we know that there are some alternatives out there. I mean, organic is certainly a familiar sort of solution, and say local, you know, small farms. But we don't really understand, most of us, how those fit into some sort of larger plan for taking the entire system. We don't know how you scale those up, for example. So our assumptions are really sort of unexplored. They're unexamined. We know something's wrong. We know we need to change something. We have some ideas of what it might be. We assume, for example, that it's going to look a lot like what we're already doing, like just maybe a bigger version of organic or a bigger version of, say, the local farm movement. More CSAs, but we don't really know how that's going to happen.
Yeah, you know, what's so interesting is that many of those ideas feel sort of new to us as we start to understand more about the way the planet is affected by the way we eat. And yet a lot of this is already out of date in some serious ways. Will you talk for a minute about Fred Fleming?
Yeah, Fred Fleming is a wheat farmer that I met. He's in eastern Washington State. It's a big wheat country. It's the Palouse, and it's some of the most productive wheat farm country in the world, and Fred is a dyed-in-the-wool, you know, conservative Republican. Comes from a long line of, you know, very conventional farmers. Used the latest industrial technology and never questioned it. And then, you know, a few years ago, he began to realize that he was essentially losing his most important asset, his soil, through a method of growing production where they till the soil repeatedly to get rid of weeds, to sort of prepare the soil for planting. And because this is a hilly area, because they get these flash floods, these gully washer rainstorms, and a lot of wind, what you were doing was with the tilling was you were breaking up the soil, destroying its structure. So it wasn't able to stick together, and it was washing away or blowing away. And these guys were losing, you know, 7 to 10 tons of topsoil every year per acre.
Which is really not replaceable at all in any easy way.
No, for intents and purposes, it's gone. So he looks at this, realizes he's basically, you know, pouring his livelihood down the drain, and decides to go to a different form. And it's called no-till, which is practiced all over the place. But in this neck of the woods and with this crop, it was sort of new. And no-till is where you don't go and break up the sod every year. You just poke the seeds through the sod, and they grow up, and the shoots come up through the sod. And he was able to keep his yields about the same, but reduce his erosion substantially. So he's sort of taking care of one of these big environmental costs to industrial farming, that is erosion. He's reducing that drastically while not doing too much to his yield. So that should be something that we would encourage. The problem is that because he's not tilling, if you've ever raised a garden, you know that tilling with your hoe is how you control weeds if you don't want to spray pesticide on them, and herbicide. So because he's not tilling, his fields are in danger of getting weeds, so he reserves the right, if you will, to spray some Roundup herbicide. Now, he doesn't use near as much as a conventional farmer does, and he's very mindful of the idea that, you know, he's using an industrial pesticide. And further, because he's curbed erosion substantially, he's not getting near the runoff of the pesticide. You know, he's sort of keeping it local, if you will. But because he's using any, he doesn't qualify for organic, which means he can't charge the organic price premium that an organic farmer can. And he also runs into a little resistance from the pure organic community because they don't feel very comfortable allowing some chemicals because they feel like that's a slippery slope. And yet, here's a guy who's found a way to scale up what, in my mind, is an improved form of agriculture. It might not be where we want to be ultimately, but it's certainly a great stepping stone. So It's sort of the paradox. Here's a way to increase, keep maintaining supplies of food while reducing some of the environmental impacts, and yet it doesn't qualify under sort of current assumptions about what makes sustainable food. And it really forces you to ask, well, what do we mean by sustainable? And is what we're currently doing, does that model need to be sort of rethought?
What's so disturbing about that resistance he gets from standard organic farmers is that they're setting up sort of a disincentive for standard farmers to make at least significantly better choices in terms of the environment.
Well, they are. That's exactly right. They're a lot of farmers, farmers aren't unaware of what's going on. They pay attention. Some may, disbelieve some of the claims made about the environmental impacts of industrial farming, but most recognize that, this isn't a perfect world. What they're really afraid of is taking the risk of changing their model, because it does entail a lot of risk, and they don't want to lay out a lot of cash for a new crop using new methods, or at least methods that are new to them, without the sort of guarantees that being able to spray pesticides or fertilize with nitrogen fertilizer. I mean, without those guarantees, you feel like you're taking a lot of risk, and a lot of farmers, that improves their comfort level, because these chemicals sort of ensure a certain level of output, and to be able to step outside that box, if you will, that takes a pretty bold move. So finding ways to induce a larger number of farmers to take maybe a slightly smaller risk, I think that's an important step here. And, there's not like one kind of organic farmer here. There's a lot of people in the organic community that recognize that their model needs to be refined. So there's a lot of interest in improving and broadening and updating this model. And I think what we're really now doing is debating in which direction those updates should occur.
So let's get this right on the table, Paul. What would be required if we were to decide tomorrow that we were going to grow every calorie of food consumed on Earth by fully organic methods? Just let's talk about in terms of land use.
Well, here's the thing. Now, this is a huge debate. I mean, if you look at how people, ideally, the way that you're farming organically, when we originally were talking about organic 100 years ago, organic was in response to this industrialization of the farm system, by which we mean separating farming, which had been sort of an integrated operation, pulling that apart. And so you're doing your livestock in one place and your crop in one place. And so that means you're not fertilizing yourself with your animals, so you have to buy the fertilizer. So you see this sort of domino effect. Once you've rationalized the system, you introduce new problems. So the idea of organic was sort of to reintegrate your farm, bring livestock back on, maybe use cover crops, rotations, using cover crops to sort of restore the fertility in between your cash crops. Well, that's the ideal, but because organic farmers, like everyone else, exist in the real economy, they are, trying to maximize their income and lower their costs, so they don't want to really deal with livestock necessarily, because that's a whole other operation, area of expertise. So instead they import their manure. And that means it has to come from a feedlot somewhere, and that feedlot has to be not only organic, but it has to have cows, and those cows have to be fed, so that means grain from some source. You begin realizing that in order to produce enough manure to fertilize a global organic system, at least as we currently view it, you're talking about a lot of acres of land that will have to be devoted simply to keep those animals pooping. And, there's all kinds of estimates as to how much land we'd need. And you can also do the same sort of calculation if you say, well, instead of using livestock manure, we're going to use cover crops. We're going to, every other crop, instead of planting corn, we'll plant some clover or some legume that restores nitrogen fertilizer naturally. But in either case, that means you doubled your need for acres, because now long you've just basically cut in half your productivity, so now you have to double your acres. In either case, you look worldwide at perhaps a doubling or tripling of the acres that we would need to produce this sort of natural fertility. Now, there's a lot of debate as to whether that number is accurate, but let's assume that you just had to double or even raise by 50% the amount of acreage simply to produce the amount of food that we're producing today. You're talking about knocking down, a lot of rainforest. You're talking about turning a lot of land that shouldn't be farmed in this country, for example, that's, too delicate, too fragile, too prone to erosion. You're basically talking about taking all available acres and turning them into farms, and that's not tenable. I mean, that's basically trading one set of problems for another. So,
and in other parts of the world, that takes us into the rainforests and very, very sensitive areas.
Right. Now you have to recognize that it's a moving target, because you're saying, how do we sort of meet current projected demands for food? I mean, if we look over the next 30 years and we say we'll need this much more grain, how do we produce that organically? But those projections for how much grain we'll need take into account, they assume that we're going to, for example, eat more meat, that in developing countries, the meat component of our diet will increase. And that's important because meat, you know, as many of your listeners know, meat requires so much grain. It takes, on average, a pound, you know, 8 pounds of grain to make a pound of edible meat. So as meat intake goes up in these populations that are getting richer, you know, grain demand goes up geometrically. But if you said instead, well, what if we work for some way to reduce meat demand and make that part of our goal for a sustainable food economy, then you change the equation substantially. But what this points to is that we're focusing on supply side solutions. That's really what organic is about. That's what local production is about. It's like, well, let's find another way to produce this food that treads more lightly on the earth. What we also need to be focusing on is let's look for another way to reduce demand. And that's something that doesn't get as much attention as it ought to.
This number always hits home for me, and you have it in the piece. It takes almost a gallon of fossil fuel to make a pound of meat, beef, I should say.
Right. So there's the energy component. You know, agriculture, especially modern agriculture, is energy intensive to begin with. But when you factor in rising meat intake and you look at, you know, all the grain that you need to feed livestock and then all the water that you need to raise the grain and the, you know, fossil fuels that you need to raise the grain and the various chemicals, you know, farm chemicals that you need, you recognize that meat is a huge sort of example of caloric leverage here. And sustainability is going to have to focus on that as well. And you know, if you looked at reducing meat consumption as, let's say, one of the components of your new sort of sustainable food system, if that was one of your policies, then you get all these other benefits as well. I mean, so you reduce the load on the food system. You're not requiring so much grain and other inputs. You're not producing so much poop because, you know, we just talked about sort of organic farmers not being able to get enough. But, you know, mostly when it comes to poop, the issue is too much and how do you manage it? And as you know, we've got these massive surpluses of animal excrement that cause a massive, you know, environmental and health problem. So there's that issue, which would sort of be taken care of a bit by a reduction in meat consumption. There's the health issue, you know, eating less meat for a country like America, where we overeat substantially, would probably improve our health. So there are other issues that need to be taken into account. And that raises another issue, which is that we tend to focus on sustainability as if it were simply about producing food in ways that allows butterflies to live. And although that's a critical component, there are other sort of criteria for sustainability. For example, you know, you and I, we could find a way to make an organic Twinkie, you know, but it isn't necessarily, doesn't make that Twinkie any better for us to eat. And so I think sustainable, and if you look at some of the groups that have been pushing sustainability and being really thoughtful about it, like the Kellogg Foundation, which despite its name is actually one of the leading kind of lights in the sustainability movement, they will say that, you know, the criteria for sustainability has got to get beyond simply production issues. So their criteria is, you know, sustainable food, food that's truly sustainable, has to have, you know, a lower environmental impact. So we agree on that. But it's also got to be produced in a way that doesn't promote injustice. I mean, you can't exploit populations in order to produce your food. And it's got to be nutritious. It's not really sustainable if it's killing you, it turns out. And then lastly, it's got to be affordable. Because if we're making sustainable food that's only affordable by the elite, which is sort of the organic problem at this point, then it's not really sustainable at all. It's simply another trend.
Paul Roberts is my guest. His article in the current issue, that's March-April 2009 of Mother Jones Magazine, is called Spoiled. He's in North Texas to speak at the Owens Conference on Agricultural Sustainability and Food Safety at Austin College in Sherman. We'll return to our discussion in a moment and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer Paul Roberts. He's in town to speak to the Owens Conference on Agricultural Sustainability and Food Safety at Austin College. His article in the current issue of Mother Jones is called Spoiled. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have, of course, in this country, Paul, huge faith in emerging technology, and there are a lot of really interesting things that you write about in the piece. Will you talk for a minute about vertical farming?
Yeah, this is this really interesting idea that, you know, we, since land is going to be at a premium, in fact, it already is, that we might want to consider ways of producing food that, you know, have a smaller sort of acreage footprint. So why not build up, you know, have farming essentially in skyscrapers? And I've seen some pretty ambitious and fairly innovative designs, you know, huge skyscrapers. You can imagine them in New York. One, there's a fellow in New York, and we detail this in the article. It's, I think, 30 stories tall and can produce, you know, all sorts of hydroponic vegetables, tree fruit, chicken, even, you know, grain. It's very efficient in that it's a closed system so that it sort of recycles energy, recycles water. It is sealed sort of hermetically so you don't get a lot of diseases coming in, plant diseases that farmers typically have to sort of fight with chemicals. So you sort of take out that risk. And you've reduced the footprint. So, you know, the idea of, and this sort of focuses not simply on saving land, but the idea that, you know, most of our populations already live in big urban centers, and that's the trend. Most of us will live in cities within the next few decades, and yet most of our food production is in rural areas, and so to cut down transportation costs, wouldn't it be great to have, you know, kind of urban horticulture? And that's really what this is about. Now, this idea is great on paper. You know, one obvious challenge is that real estate in urban areas is super expensive, so one of these kind of vegetable skyscrapers would have to be competing with an office full of, say, lawyers or architects or some other professionals that could afford, you know, to pay those real estate rates. So that's something that has to be sort of considered. But, you know, on a smaller and maybe more sort of manageable scale, this notion of rooftop farming and urban farming, where you kind of incorporate horticulture into urban design, there's a lot of very interesting things that can be done there. And there's a great group in Milwaukee, I believe, Growing Power. It's run by a former NFL player who decided that, you know, what inner city people needed was access to good, healthy food, and not just, you know, the availability to eat it, but to help produce it. And he's created this whole sort of greenhouse culture where people can come in and take part in this process. And what he's discovering is that, you know, participating in food production, which is something that so few of us do anymore, has massive kind of psychological and social benefits on top of the sort of nutritional benefits. So there's a whole host of possibilities that are opened up by the notion of urban horticulture, and I think that's where a lot of great potential lies and where a lot of research needs to be done. But it's just that's a really exciting opportunity. It doesn't have to be these huge space-age skyscrapers. I mean, that may be ultimately where we're headed, but it's great. It'd be really nice to have people thinking in those directions. And what's implicit in that direction, if you will, is we have to sort of let go this notion that farming is always going to look like it always has, with a little farm and row crops and dirt and silos and a red barn. I mean, there's plenty of room for that model, and I wouldn't want to lose that for a lot of reasons. But we're also going to have to probably come up with some and accept and understand that some of these new models will be pretty bizarre looking, and they might be kind of ugly. So it won't be romantic, I guess. And that's, I guess, one of the rules of the new sustainable food system is that it probably isn't going to be romantic.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have an email here from Amanda in Fort Worth who says she works at a preschool where the kids throw away all kinds of stuff. She says for her, the heart of the problem is all the single-use and disposable items that parents pack in their kids' lunches. I believe parents should become more aware of this issue because besides the wasted food, their hard-earned money is thrown in the trash along with the uneaten applesauce. Food packaging is certainly a big issue.
Yeah, I mean, that's another part of the whole sustainability equation that gets short shrift. I mean, if you look at the sort of the local, the food miles idea really got a lot of attention, and that was one of the sort of the strengths behind local food was that you could cut your food miles. And the idea was that any food that you were buying locally had traveled fewer miles, and any food that traveled a longer distance was automatically generating more carbon emissions and sucking up more oil. And while that's generally true, if you're looking at like pure energy use or pure carbon emissions, you get more energy being used in the processing part of the supply chain as opposed to the growing or transportation. So it's how we process and package food that's really, you know, critical when it comes to reducing our sort of energy or carbon footprint. And, you know, you can often find organic food in these, like, great little individually packed packages, which are very energy intensive. So, you know, going back and kind of rethinking how we process and package food is going to be critical here, too, which means we might lose some convenience. And I think people underestimate, I think a lot of consumers who want a sustainable system really underestimate what that's going to require in terms of the time they spend on food every day. You know, if we're spending, you know, half an hour a day typically making our food, and that's like the mainstream, are we really willing to spend maybe an hour or two on our food, doing our own processing and our own sort of packaging? I mean, I think it's a question that doesn't really get raised, but it's part of sustainability.
Yeah, and the food miles thing is also an interesting debate. You write about the fact that, for example, there's one small part of Washington State that can produce more pears than anyone in Washington could ever eat, and therefore saying that those pears should not be exported all over the country is maybe not a practical thing to say.
Yeah, and it was actually in Oregon.
I'm sorry.
But just across the river. I mean, Washington has the same problem with other sort of orchard fruits, and I think any region that has any sort of agriculture going on, it can, you know, produce far more than it can consume locally or even regionally. So then the question is, well, what do you do with that capacity? And this is the whole notion of comparative advantage, which is what drove kind of global trade in the first place, the idea that, you know, people who could make widgets better than anyone else, they should focus on making widgets, sell those to other people, and then use the income to buy what they couldn't produce as efficiently. And, you know, what that's led us to do is to, you know, regionalize our food production. So you have, you know, the Midwest, and like you look at a place like Iowa, which used to produce everything, apples, all sorts of vegetables, and now its main products are corn, soybeans, and hogs, because they can produce those for a few pennies a pound cheaper than anywhere else. So that's its comparative advantage. Well, as we sort of look at long-term energy prices and say, wow, shipping all those hogs around the world, that corn or those soybeans, that's going to become so expensive that maybe Iowa loses its advantage. So we may have to shrink that a bit, but we'll never completely lose the need for global trade. If you look at a country like China or India, these are places that have already passed their capacity to be food self-sufficient. And clearly they could become more, they could redesign their food models and be more sustainable. But if they're not there now, they shortly will be at a place where they have to import. There's no way they can get around importing. So you have that on one side of the equation. Then you look at a country like the United States, which is blessed with a lot of really, really productive acres, particularly in the Midwest. You've got, you know, many feet thick topsoil, and you can produce more food than you can possibly consume. And even if we move to an entirely sustainable model, we'd still be able to produce more food than we can consume. So there's a natural affinity between a sort of a surplus producer like the United States and a deficit country like China, and that has to be dealt with through global trade. But maybe what we need to think of as food trade as sort of a hierarchy of scales. You know, you have local and regional where it makes sense, and you have global where it makes sense, and you maybe ship your staples like grain globally, but you maybe do a little less shipping things like endive and spinach, because those make much more sense to sort of produce locally, particularly if energy costs go up. But the idea that we're going to, you know, build the next system out of a bunch of local farms, it doesn't work. You know, think about where most of the people in this country live. We live primarily on the coasts, and yet, you know, a huge fraction of the productive land is in the Midwest. So we've locked ourselves into, simply by where we live, the need for some sort of non-local trade, and that pattern, that reality is not going to go away.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Bert in Dallas. Hi, Bert.
Hi. I sort of wanted to, before I get to my question, I wanted to testify to the consumer problem when you try to start to eat like this through a CSA, or I'm a big grass-fed beef aficionado, it is much more expensive and much more inconvenient to try to organize that delivery of meat and the quantities that you have to buy to make that worthwhile, and then the quality issues so that can, because it can vary much more. And it's a real sacrifice to try to eat as a more sensitive consumer to the environment, you know. But let me get to one point. You know, Michael Pollan writes about these farms, or one in particular, where, you know, the pigs eat in the woods and the cattle go through the grass and then the chickens follow the cattle. But one component to make these things work seems to be specialized breeds and we'll have to get away from some of the breeds that have been specialized for factory farming. So I wanted you to comment on that. How much more information, knowledge, and changing of breeds of plants and animals would have to occur before we could really make advancements in that kind of farming?
Well, Bert, this is dead on. I mean, you've got a system. I mean, essentially, to industrialize food, you know, it wasn't just building big plants or big farms. It was re-engineering the food to fit those models. So we had to come up with fruits and vegetables that were that could be harvestable by machine, which meant breeding, you know, breeds that were going to be tougher, that wouldn't get mashed, and it meant coming up with livestock that would fatten up quickly or was amenable to certain kinds of diets. So yes, we've completely bent our sort of produce and livestock and grain varieties to fit the industrial model. And if we want to sort of deindustrialize to some degree, we're going to need to think about different kinds of breeds. Probably we're going to be very interested. In fact, this is clear, you know, as we sort of look at coming up with alternative systems, we become very interested in some of the breeds that people were, you know, using before. And we're going to have to find, for example, chickens that, thrive in a sort of a free-range environment. But what's critical, I think, is to recognize that we can't go back. Because if you look at, say, the chicken model of 100 years ago, it laid eggs and produced meat, which is why you got these scrawny chickens. And the notion of a spring, chicken was tough because these birds were older and they had run around a lot. And this notion of a spring chicken, that was the only time you ever got tender chicken. So we need to come up with probably different breeds. They're not going to be able to go back, but we're probably going to want to use a lot of that information that was there. But, you know, we do have a lot of things to recover. And we are going to have to rethink every piece of the system. It's not just going to be breeds, but it's going to be methods of fertilizing, as we've already talked about. We're going to have to rethink our expectations as consumers for how much time we ought to be spending on food. You know, Bert talks about how it is inconvenient to make these arrangements, but I imagine that you know, if he went back 50 years and talked to people in his family, how much time were they spending sort of arranging their food, it probably would be comparable to what he's dealing with today. So I think there's going to be a whole sort of educational element here where we talk ourselves into different expectations and, recognize that half an hour a day probably isn't enough. And I think the last thing is, I think we need to sort of re-identify ourselves as not being consumers anymore. It's a pretty vulgar term if you think about it. When did we sort of allow that to happen? And I you kind of think, okay, what's a consumer economy? Well, that's when most of the things that are produced end up being consumed, as opposed to a producer economy, which is when most of what you bought was, you know, you were a farmer or you produced something. So most of what you bought was a raw material to turn into a finished good. Well, I don't know that we can get back to that. So maybe we aren't going to become producers instead of consumers, but I'd at least settle for being citizens, you know. So maybe that's a good first step.
Is there any reasonable argument to be made that, you know, when we trade convenience foods away and we bring whole products into our homes, that ultimately there is some energy consumed by consumers, by individual citizens, as they put this food back together again? So in other words, maybe you're spending an extra, you know, hour with the oven on and the stove on and sort of creating these things that way.
Yeah, I mean, I'd guarantee, you know, you're gonna be spending more in terms of energy at home, and your time, that's obviously valuable too. I think if you did the equation, if you were doing, there's so much energy used in processing and packaging. If you can skip that process, even if you're having to do your own canning or your own putting up in the freezer, you're probably coming out ahead. Now, I don't have numbers to back it up, so I'll just say that's speculative. But I would assume that that's probably, the trade-off is probably pretty close. Secondly, there's other benefits to that shift that may not be as tangible or as measurable, but are clearly, I mean, I think kind of restoring the food function to the household would have so many benefits on a personal and social family level. I mean, everyone knows at some place in their psyche how damaging it's been to get away from sort of communal and family eating. Now, individuals may have families they didn't want to sit down and eat dinner with, and I recognize that. But generally speaking, this idea of people who, if you look at the numbers of how rarely we sit down and have a dinner together, and the way that, you know, families now, may a person who's cooking it, maybe it's the mom or dad, or maybe it's the kids now, they'll be cooking four or five different meals at mealtime because everyone has different tastes, and the food industry has sort of latched onto that and now provides easy-to-make individual meals so that a family can have, you know, individual tastes. Well, that's great and that's convenient, but think of the things that transpired, the sort of the social capital that was produced when we sat down and had a family meal because everyone was forced to kind of eat the same thing. So much of the family is built at the table, and that's disappearing. Now, this isn't going to solve all our social problems, but I'd be willing to bet large sums that we would solve a few by having a culture that sort of supported the idea of producing food and didn't try to flee from it as fast as we have for the last couple of decades.
Yeah, it speaks to the fact, I guess, that we're still learning. At first, we thought it was great that we could have all this mass-produced, factory-made food, and then didn't realize at the time, as we put all this in place, what we'd be trading away.
Yeah, but that's a really important point, because recognize that there were true and measurable benefits to moving toward a more factory system. I mean, if you go back to 1900, where the average household is spending half of its income and half of its labor hours keeping itself fed, that's not something you want to go back to. And keep in mind further that the person doing the labor was more often than not the woman. So, you know, we've come a long way, you know, but going down from 4 hours to a half an hour, we've clearly gone too far. So finding going back on that line and finding the correct balance point, I think that's one of the challenges we're looking at.
Paul Roberts is my guest. You can read his article, Spoiled, in the current issue of Mother Jones Magazine. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Paul Roberts is my guest. He is in North Texas to speak to the Owens Conference on Agricultural Sustainability and Food Safety at Austin College in Sherman. His article in the current issue, that's March-April 2009, of Mother Jones, is called Spoiled. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. So there's this idea of consumer demand driving potentially more sustainable agriculture. You also think there is a huge role that we haven't yet discussed for the federal government in terms of changing the way it purchases food for federal programs. What are the requirements right now?
Well, I mean, right now, I mean, it depends sort of what food type you're talking about, what agency, but there's a huge emphasis on making cost the only criteria, you know, the low bidder gets to be the one who supplies a federal agency with food. And this is sort of the model that we, you know, use throughout our society, and which is always going to favor the big low-cost producers, typically in the Midwest. And I think that, you know, if we were to switch, if we were to shift procurement policy so that they gave some preference, they weighted in some way suppliers who were local or regional, you'd have this, you'd create demand for local and regionally produced food that isn't there right now, and you'd see a huge response. You know, the market would say, okay, well, that's what you want us to produce, we can produce it. And we know that local and regional systems can be a lot more productive than they are right now if they're given some financial incentive, some support. So that's clearly, I mean, as I said, we're not going to feed everyone with local and regional systems, but we could do a heck of a lot more than we're doing now, and we really need to sort of discover what that potential is, and the way to do that is to provide incentives, and so that's, a target for support. So maybe if you're looking for ways to rethink the farm program and how we spend our subsidies, I think finding ways to support, you know, that kind of production would be really great. And in the federal, the government should be leading the way. You know, and I think that so that's one I think area where the federal government can really step in. And I think another, and probably it's at least as important, is, you know, we're sort of on the cusp of a food revolution. There's growing awareness. There's growing public support for it. We're not there yet. I think we're still some ways away. But when we do get there, we will sort of go, okay, let's build a new food system, and we will look at one another and say, with what? Because we don't really have the tools, the research that we need to do this. We realize we're going to need a host of new crops. Your caller, Bert, points out we're going to need to rethink the kinds of animals we have. And, you know, we've let the amount of money we spend on researching what you might call alternative food, that's just, it's a drop in the bucket. So we need to fill the research pipeline, because it takes, you know, 5 to 10 years to get this kind of research going, to get the answers ready, which means that we should have started, you know, a while ago. And that's something that needs to be done. So companies are often reluctant, private companies are often reluctant to take the risks with those research because they don't know if it will be profitable. But that is a role that the government can rightly take, because government should be taking those kinds of risks. There's a note of caution, though, and that is that we have really gotten and bought into the idea of a technological fix for all our problems. And what's really, you know, been sort of reemphasized at the Owens Conference here today is that technology is going to play a big part, a huge part, and in ways that we can't imagine. But most of the problems we have to deal with are sort of more systems. They're more about the system than the technology. You know, for example, the top priority, whether it's a government program or the endeavor of an individual, the top priority, if we want to ensure that we can feed everyone forever, is that we maintain soil health. You know, you're not going to be able to feed populations 100 years from now if you've eroded all the soil. So if you make your top priority, okay, we need soil, what do we need to do to maintain soil health? And you start looking at what's happening to the soil worldwide in the United States, you recognize, okay, that is one of the biggest risks to a sustainable food system. And by sustainable here, I don't necessarily mean green. I simply mean one that exists. So what do you need to do to restore soil health? We start kind of backing up from that, reverse engineering that, and it's like, oh, my God, we've got to take care of, you know, these heavily tilled operations, and we have to make sure we're not sucking all the organic matter, the carbon, out of the soil. There was an interesting figure I just came across the other day where if you look at, you know, typically if you measure soil, it's got anywhere from 3 to 5% of organic matter if by weight. And the problem is if you simply grow plants year after year, you suck that carbon, that organic matter, out of the field. And if you're just replacing it with chemical fertilizers, you're not replacing the whole package. And when organic matter leaves, you not only lose the capacity to grow plants, but organic matter does other things, like it stores water. And simply going up, increasing your organic matter by 1%, almost quintuples the amount of water that you can hold in that soil. So these are, and we're recognizing there's probably going to be more droughts in the future. So if we're looking for ways to sort of climate-proof our agriculture, restoring organic matter and therefore soil health is critical. And yet, mostly when we talk about alternatives or the farm bill, soil health is never even mentioned. So that's, I think, reorienting how we focus on this, coming up with some long-term goals. You know, a couple of people here are talking about Wes Jackson, for example, who runs Land Institute, is talking about the need for a 50-year farm bill. Because most of our farm bills are in 5-year increments, and that's just not long enough to really understand what's at stake here or how long it's going to take to restore some of these systems. We need a 50-year approach, and that's something that's almost foreign to our entire way of policymaking.
So how do we begin to prioritize the pros and cons, given that every way of producing food has trade-offs?
Well, I guess, you know, that's sort of the $64 million question, because we've allowed the market to prioritize, and the market has assigned, you know, certain value to things, and we've responded to those prices. Those have sort of led the way. They've provided the signals. Once we know the price of something, we say, okay, now I know what to do. If oil is expensive, I'll use less of it. If it's cheap, I'll use more. Even if it's cheap because we're in the middle of a recession, and that doesn't have to have anything to do with how much oil is actually left. So we're using more. We're behaving inappropriately, even though we're sort of behaving rationally. So we need to maybe recalibrate how we value food. I mean, it doesn't make sense. There's an economist named Joshua Farley at the conference who points out that diamonds are vastly more expensive than water, and yet diamonds are worthless, you know, when you think about it, and water is priceless and irreplaceable. So clearly there's a little disconnect between how the market prices and what things are truly worth. Coming up with a better valuation process is critical, but that's very complicated because it's a very political issue. It's like one person's value is another person's valuelessness. So we have to look for things that have value we can all agree on, and that's where we're sort of inching toward with carbon, you know, the whole climate issue. We recognize that much of agriculture is a huge contributor to climate change, and that if we want to deal with climate change, we're going to have to deal with agriculture and maybe assigning a price to carbon. And once we've assigned a price to carbon, then the market, the agricultural market, can then respond in a truly sustainable way, or at least a way that's more sustainable. So that's one of those, I think, we, you know, taking long-term approach, looking at things like soil health and working backwards and saying, okay, what do we need to do to maintain that? And then looking for ways on which we can build consensus around real pricing, and maybe carbon offers a way for that. So these are some of these kind of long-term, large-scale, heavy-lifting things where government has a real, you know, a necessary role. But let me just, you know, qualify that with yet another qualification. Keep in mind that there's a critical role for individuals and communities. Many of your listeners probably heard the story where they pointed out that individual savings rates were finally going up. You know, after years of overspending, we were actually saving more, and that was great for the individual, but it was destroying the economy because we require overconsumption to get the economy going. So what you recognize is what's good for the collective or on the national level is bad individually. That has to be kept in mind in terms of food. If you do, if you simply look at how many calories we're overconsuming, if you're looking at the obesity issue, and there's a big debate about how much that is, but let's say it's 50 calories a day. If everyone reduced their daily consumption by 50 calories a day, it would be good for us on an individual level, but in the United States, I'm talking about, but on a national level, it would reduce, you know, income substantially. It would take, you know, anywhere from $15 to $30 billion out of the food system. That represents a lot of jobs. So you have to recognize that what is going to make sense from the government standpoint in terms of broad national policy may not be good for individuals and communities. And so that is why you need individual effort, you know, individuals sort of looking, what's going to work for me? What's going to work for my neighbors and my community? And that's why this grassroots, to see so many grassroots efforts, people working to build local farms, urban horticulture, people working to improve nutrition in communities that are cut off from access to good food, why those efforts are so critical. And that's why I'm so encouraged, actually. When I see dismal news on the national level, I get pretty discouraged, but then I come and visit, you know, a community like this where people are, you know, trying to build local systems that are sustainable, and it's pretty uplifting to see that.
Let's go out next to Argyle and speak with Oscar. Hey, Oscar.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't want to ramble on, so I'll try and make my remarks short. Number one, I just want to thank you guys for having this conversation. Not only, you know, technically the detail that you're going over, but the tone in which you have this conversation. I'll just mention two examples of that. One, when you were talking about the family eating together, and how that time was being decreased and what the results of it were and what were some of the factors, you know, causing that lack of time to eat together, and your analysis of that situation and what can come out of it socially and what's good about it. And then just recently you mentioned about the looking at the 50-year farm bills, you know, having the idea that, you know, having a view to the future that may or may not include me, myself, as living and enjoying the results of that decision, you know, recognize that this farmer in 50 years will be gaining the benefit from it and approaching it that way so that we become sort of like stewards of, you know, the current situation, not just a consumer of what we're sitting on right now and, you know, suck it dry for what we've got. So, and that's what I see around me a lot. Just, you know, culturally, you know, I have friends who are working just crazy hard to achieve goals that, you know, as kind as the guy is, as kind as my friends are, you know, some of them, I think they're working hard for goals that are objectively not good for them.
Well, Oscar, you bring up an interesting point. This really is, Paul, a different way of approaching how we do things, because we do not live on a 50-year timeline. People extrapolate and think, well, in 50 years, I'll either not be here or I'll be too old to care.
Right, then that's, you know, but if you, you know, somehow back in the old days, we were able to sort of, you know, there were certain things that you just didn't violate in terms of how you treated your land, and that had to do both with your own survival, but you needed something to be able to pass on. Now, I don't think people back 500 years ago are any better than they are today. It's just that we've been able to substitute sustainable practices for cheap energy or cheap inputs for a long time, and a lot of that has had to do with the fact that we've been burning through, say, oil at a rate slightly faster than the rate at which the oil was produced millions of years ago. So you know, we've been able to substitute sustainability for cheap inputs, and as those inputs get less cheap, we'll recognize that we're going to have to go, that what we'll sort of burn will be sort of knowledge, and it'll be information and sort of cultural understanding. And a lot of that is in a danger of being lost. You know, Wes Jackson made a really great point about an hour ago here at the conference, and he said that high energy use destroys information. You know, it makes it possible for people to fragment families, for people to leave the farm, to farm in ways that have, you know, no regard for sustainable practices, because you can import your fertility, you can import your pesticides. You don't have to control by kind of understanding the pests, understanding the natural cycles of your own landscape. Well, high energy is one of the things that allows that to happen, and we're destroying information, we're destroying the very knowledge base that is essential for this. So part of what we're going to need to restore when we're restoring our soil and our health is information as well. And that's really hard to do. That's a long-term process, and that's another 50-year or 100-year process. But, you know, whether we're talking about climate or food or say, water, that's a whole other issue we could talk about, or energy, all of these are long-term projects. And we're going to need to start with a mindset that looks beyond the corporate quarter, labor, you know, corporate report, looks beyond the 1 and 2 year time frame and even the 10 year time frame. And you know, we do that sometimes with our retirement. We're planning for things for our kids, estate planning. So it's not completely foreign to us. We used to do it all the time, and I think it's time to find ways to get back to that. And you can't make a law that forces people to do that. That comes out of the culture, that comes out of the conversations that people have. Those are the things that help people decide how they want to live and how they want to plan their lives. And so I think it's conversations like this. It's conferences. It's, you know, schools coming up with environmental science and sustainability programs that they weren't doing that 5 years ago. I think there is a conversation going on, and it's really encouraging. And like I said, you know, some days I wake up and I think there's no way we're going to do it. We're not going to be able to feed all ourselves. But, you know, here, the bottom line is this. We know what the worst case is. We all die. And really, anything we can do to avoid that, to step back from that one or two steps, is a form of success. And we got to graduate from this idea that was really, you know, key in the environmental community, which is that we need a perfect solution. Well, we're not going to get a perfect solution. In all these areas, energy, climate, you know, environmental degradation, we've already passed the point of a perfect solution. And the perfect is the enemy of the good. We just need to get something that's sustainable. And I think that understanding is finally starting to sink in.
Paul Roberts' article, Spoiled, appears in the March-April issue of Mother Jones Magazine. Paul, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, thanks for reaching out.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.